Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today we have a guest on who is no stranger to us at the Historical Society, nor to people who enjoy South Dakota's most famous, or perhaps one of the most famous, residents. Pamela Smith Hill is here today to walk us through her new book entitled Too Good to Be Altogether Lost, Rediscovering Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House Books. Pamela is a best-selling author, editor, educator, and expert on Laura Ingalls Wilder. She's edited and written books, including two books with the South Dakota Historical Society Press, and those being Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography, and a biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. So Pamela, welcome to History 605.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You and I had a chance recently to chat at the Laura Palooza that occurred in Sioux Falls, South Dakota in July, and that conference really intrigued me in so many ways, and your presentation, I think, was really revealing. I had heard that the book was coming out, but after listening to your presentation, I thought, okay, I think maybe this book is for me. And by me, meaning somebody who is north of the age of 13 and just has more of an interest in how books are put together, but certainly just a general interest in how writing is done and good writing and good novels, how they come together. And I was always been impressed with Laura Ingalls Wilder, having read her work as a kid. But then your presentation, I thought, okay, wow, I think there's a richer vein here that has been underappreciated, if not perhaps totally ignored. So I wanted to have you on the show, and we can talk about this after I had a chance to spend some more time with the book. So just to be precise, this book is a story, it seems to me, this book is a story about the story, and it's both history and a literary work. So I think it'd be interesting to people who are both interested in novels and novel writing and English teachers, and as well as historians and those who are interested about South Dakota's past. So let's start with the title, which is a great place to start. And it's in many ways the gist of the book. Where does that title come from? Too Good to Be Altogether Lost.
The title comes from Laura Ingalls Wilder herself. In 1937, she was invited to speak at the Detroit Book Fair. And in her speech, she talked about the origins of the Little House books, and specifically how important her father's stories were to the development of the Little House books. And in the context of her father's stories, she said that they were too good to be altogether lost. And I thought, given what has happened to Wilder's reputation over the last 30 years, that line, too good to be altogether lost, seemed to apply not just to the stories from Wilder's childhood that inspired her, but to the Little House series themselves. Because I do think, as works of American literature, they are too good to be altogether lost.
As you get into your book, that comes through chapter after chapter. You have an interesting preface, though, and you indicate that literary academics and those who deal with, and you alluded to maybe we've lost some in the last 20, 30 years of the Laura Ingalls Wilder meaning, you really come out swinging in your preface against kind of a technical term that we in the history business would call presentism, and literary criticism presentism too. What is presentism, and what's your take on it, and how do you approach that?
Presentism, I should point out, and I do in the book, as a concept, really would have been a known to Laura Ingalls Wilder. But in essence, presentism is judging the past, whether it's a work of literature or a work of historical significance, is judging the actions, the attitudes, the concepts that governed that world by the present day. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it's judging, in the context of Wilder, the 19th century and the early 20th century when she was writing the books, by 21st century standards. And let me give you a really quick example of this.
Sure.
I was listening to, and I was part of a radio podcast several years ago on Wilder, and one of the producers was talking to her son, who I think was probably about 8 or 9 years old. And he didn't like Little House on the Prairie because Laura Ingalls Wilder called Native Americans Indians and did not use the term Native Americans to describe them. And the mother said, "Oh, that's brilliant. What a wonderful observation." Well, in essence, that's presentism, because when Laura Ingalls Wilder was writing the book, the term Native Americans was not in use. It was certainly not in use in the 1870s, which is the time period that that Wilder used for Little House on the Prairie. So that very precocious 8-year-old was judging and criticizing Wilder by 21st century standards, and criticizing her for something that she would not have even been aware of. Native Americans, I don't think, came into wide usage until the 1970s. So that's an example of presentism. And historians, I think, in the past have been very wary about the idea of judging the past exclusively by 21st century standards or contemporary standards. But in literary circles, that is becoming more and more accepted. So when I was writing young adult historical fiction in the 1990s, we attempted, those of us who are writing more literary novels, we attempted to portray our characters and use the vocabulary that they used in our books, even though we were writing for contemporary readers. So, for example, when I wrote my Civil War novel, A Voice from the Border, when I was doing the research, the only contemporary material I read were histories about the Civil War. For the 2 years that I was researching that book, I read those histories, but I read poetry, novels, newspaper accounts that all dated from the 19th century. So that would have been material that my characters would have read, because I really wanted to try to be as authentic as I could. Now, anytime a writer is writing about the past, there's going to be a certain amount of contemporary ideas that slip in, but consciously I was trying to get as close to the Civil War period as I could and still be relevant to contemporary readers. These days, a lot of that has changed. So whether you're writing for middle grade, young adult, or even adult readers these days, a lot of authors really don't care about that kind of authenticity. And so that they are really writing essentially kind of costume dramas, and their characters are 21st century characters, maybe set in ancient Egypt or in the Regency period, or even 1920s and 1930s. And so, for example, young characters may be dropping a lot of F-bombs in their dialogue, which, of course, they never would have done, even in the 1930s or even in the 1960s or 1970s. So presentism has now creeped in and to literature and into literary circles, and it's now much more accepted.
Yeah, it seems that the opportunity we have to try and understand the past certainly begins with language and the meaning of the words they were using. Your example of Native American. I have American Indian friends, and they'll tell me I prefer to be called Lakota, or I prefer to be called Gatsa, or whatever the case may be. And so I have a personal policy of calling people to what they wish to be called. And
I know
some friends who are adamantly opposed to being called one of those or the others. I mean, so it just kind of comes down to an individual basis, but I think if the American Indian movement can be called American Indian, then.
Well, in the chapter on Little House on the Prairie, I usually identify the characters, although Wilder didn't do this, as the Osage, because the book is really dealing with the Osage people. And I wanted to be very specific about that.
Right. Well, and it's helpful, too, once you know, say, the Osage, you're dealing with that tribe, then it tips readers off to, well, which Indians where, what time? And if they want to find out more, then they've got a path as opposed to.
And I have to say, I just want to add here that, you know, living in South Dakota as I did for 8 years, I became much more sensitized to language and how we identify Indigenous people. And like you, I learned to listen to my friends who were, most of them were Dakota. I think Americans in general, if they don't live in a part of the world where there's a significant Indigenous population, they don't quite understand the distinctions and how important those are.
Right. Well, later in the book, you bring up several of these issues along these lines. And one of the things that Wilder's often, words that she wrote in her book originally, that are often thrown back at her is when she says, and there were no people here, only Indians lived there. You helpfully kind of go through the part and explain that. I wonder if you could maybe approach that particular sentence, which I think was in Little House on the Prairie.
It was originally printed in the first version. And in the 1950s, early 1950s, Wilder's editor at Harper & Brothers, a very famous children's book editor named Ursula Nordstrom, received a letter from a reader who was very upset about that line. And so Nordstrom got in touch with Wilder, and they ended up changing the line. And Wilder said, of course, I didn't mean to imply that Indians were not people. That was a stupid, I'm paraphrasing here.
Right,
that was a stupid mistake of mine. In 1953, Harper & Brothers, Wilder's publisher, issued an updated and new version of the Little House books. And that's the one most of us grew up with.
Okay.
The one that featured the illustrations by Garth Williams. And so from 1953 on, they changed that line. And it was, I think, the first criticism that Wilder received openly about her depiction of American Indian people in her books. And she was very sensitive to that and changed it. And then she died in 1957, decades before the groundswell of criticism developed about her portrayal.
Part of your argument in the book, I think, that's built up about what is too good to be altogether lost, is this rich discussion that we can learn about the past by having a conversation, just like Laura did with one of her readers via her editor and so forth, about what that line meant to her at the time and the viewpoint that a woman of her experience and age would have written that in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. But just having that discussion, I think, is what your book is about. It's a long, sustained discussion about many things about the books, but that aspect of her background and so forth is a rich one that would be, in my view, altogether too good to be lost. I wonder if you, each one of your chapters, you build and you kind of bring about her larger meaning to novel writing and to literature that I had never really contemplated much at all. And you really demonstrate that she is a pathbreaker in so many ways in children's literature and how she's done that. And so I guess I'd like to spend the rest of the time just talking about those pathbreaking that she creates about this, about children's literature, young adult literature, and her ability to kind of sense where the audience is. And what I found kind of revealing was this frequent argument that she's having, discussions that she's having with Rose and maybe an editor, Rose, her daughter, about character development and what's next and how the narrative should move forward and so forth. And she seems to have a far better eye on things than Rose does, which might be a bit of a talking point or something to push on a little bit. So I wonder, how does the Little House in the Big Woods create something new in novel writing? What's the first chapter do?
Well, when Laura Ingalls Wilder received an acceptance letter from her first editor at Harper and Brothers, and again, I'm going to be paraphrasing, her editor, who was Virginia Kirkus, was totally enchanted by the manuscript. And she said, well, you know, there just aren't that many books that deal with the frontier experience for children. And this one is really unique and wonderful. Well, in fact, Wilder was already writing in an established literary trend. The idea of writing about the pioneer experience in the early 20th century was an established almost genre, beginning with Willa Cather, moving on to Bess Streeter Aldrich. Of course, they were writing for adult readers, but there were several writers and who were already writing for children about the pioneer experience. So with Little House in the Big Woods in particular, what was unique about that book, and it sets it apart from pretty much the rest of the series, because when she wrote that book, she wasn't envisioning a series yet. But she introduced realism into the book. All of those details about how the family gathered food and prepared for the winter, that pig's bladder that Laura and Mary play catch with that everybody remembers. All of those details were really striking and unique. But then she paired that kind of realism, those realistic details, with kind of a fairy tale setting. So that Little House in the Big Woods is at once a pioneer novel, and it's also an American fairy tale, so to speak. And that was very unique and very different. And it moves from, it follows the cycle of a year, as fairy tale stories often do. It's almost like following a year and a day, which is a very magical kind of time period. And instead of dealing with dragons and sorcerers, you're dealing with wolves and panthers, and life is very, life is filled with danger and excitement, but also with joy and wonder. So in that book in particular, Little House in the Big Woods, it was a really interesting blend, a fairy tale story with an ensemble cast. And in fact, I think you could almost make the case for Pa being the main character in that book.
Right.
So these wonderful, fully developed characters in the American West, but in kind of a fairy tale atmosphere. That was new. That was unique. And as Virginia Kirkus once said, it was the book that no depression could stop. It was such an uplifting story and full of magic and wonder and realism all at the same time. So that was very, very unusual for the period. And none of the other children's book writers, what was then known as juvenile fiction writers, were doing anything like that in the 1930s. And then, of course, she makes a bigger leap when she writes Farmer Boy, which is kind of the mirror image of Little House in the Big Woods. Little House in the Big Woods is about a frontier family living in the 19th century and what their everyday life was like. And Farmer Boy is also set in the 19th century, but it has a really strong main character, a boy. It's kind of the mirror image of Little House in the Big Woods. But they're a family in the East living in the 19th century. So those two books in the series are kind of self-contained. But in Farmer Boy, she makes this other leap into more realism and following one juvenile character in particular, and that, of course, is Almanzo Wilder. So it is totally his story. There are other characters. The family is important in Farmer Boy, but Almanzo Wilder is always front and center. And so that was kind of a leap for her. And I will say that among all the Little House books, I would have to say that Farmer Boy is the most conventional book in the series.
Okay.
But it's also the only book in the series that Wilder wrote, which was not purely, that didn't have any significant autobiographical foundation. There's one right. episode in Farmer Boy that Wilder pulled from her own experience, but otherwise she was writing kind of outside of herself, and that was more conventional. And then when she wrote Little House on the Prairie, that's when she really started to explode a lot of the conventions in juvenile literature of the period.
Well, and all this time as she's trying to get these books published, what's the immediate reaction to Little House in the Big Woods? Or does it sell well right away?
I think it sold respectably. The first three books in the Little House series got absolutely no attention from the American Library Association. Little House in the Big Woods, Farmer Boy, Little House on the Prairie. None of them received any recognition from the American Library Association. And by that, I mean, they were not named as Newbery Honor Books or named as Newbery winners. And for your listeners out there, the Newbery is the Oscar of children's literature. And of course, it's still the Oscar today in 2025. So Wilder's books passed under the radar then. And I think in part because she was doing something so unique and different. And that's particularly true of Little House on the Prairie.
Do you think that she's having conversations with, she had to have been having conversations with Almanzo to kind of populate the storyline for Farmer's Boy? Do we have any record of that? Or
we don't have any record of how she wrote it. The only records that we have some limited correspondence between Wilder and her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane. I will say Farmer Boy was a difficult book, I think, for Wilder to write because she wrote it, she began writing it shortly after she finished Little House in the Big Woods. She wrote it and sent it in to her publisher in 1932, and her publisher rejected it. They rejected Farmer Boy in the beginning. And there's a lot of other drama going on at the time that Wilder got that rejection letter. And in part, it might have been rejected because Wilder had a new editor at Harper & Brothers, and often new editors have a different take on how they want to work with a writer. Sometimes they will reject a piece even though they like it a great deal and they just want the writer to go back and rewrite and revise a bit. They want to figure out how willing a writer is to revise and rework the novel. So it was rejected. So getting back to your question, I'm sure she probably talked to Almanzo about it, but when the novel was rejected and before she began rewriting Farmer Boy, Rose was back east on a trip and she went to Malone, New York and visited Almanzo's family farm and sent Wilder some specific impressions of what the farm was like and what the setting looked like, what the landscape was like. And so I think in that instance, Rose played a valuable role in helping Wilder figure out what to do with Farmer Boy and how to revise it and make it a more marketable book.
Okay.
And the other thing about Farmer Boy too, I didn't really linger on this in the book, but when Wilder signed the contract for Farmer Boy, she wasn't earning the same level of royalties that she had earned before with Little House in the Big Woods. Now, her editor told her that it had nothing to do with the sales of Little House in the Big Woods or the quality of Farmer Boy. It was just that publishers were having to cut back on royalties across the board because their financial situation was worsening because of the Great Depression.
Right.
But that bothered Wilder for several years to come. And she actually later on worked with an agent to renegotiate royalties for Farmer Boy.
Well, I guess if the books might have been recession proof, but there was certainly an impact on royalties and other things, imagine, and how they could market it. And I would imagine, I don't know that you talk much about this. Do you think she's writing to an audience that's undergoing the Depression as the books advance? Does she realize that she's writing to people who now probably value how to make a dollar go as far as possible than in the 1920s, that probably wasn't as such a keen concept?
I think she was absolutely aware of the Depression and its effect on farm families. Of course, Wilder was a farm journalist before he began writing the Little House books. She was also the secretary treasurer of a farm loan association in Mansfield. And she and Almanzo and Rose Wilder Lane also suffered major financial losses during the Depression. So she was coping with that firsthand. So I think it's very clear in the depiction of the Ingalls family, and we haven't really talked about this, from Little House on the Prairie on through the end of the series, she brought a new emotional realism to her characters. And I think that emotional realism, dealing with hardships, dealing with failure, dealing with loss, those were all concepts that young readers in the 1930s would have understood and appreciated in her work. And of course, she brought optimism into all of that. But if you read, particularly On the Banks of Plum Creek, which is about failure and loss, that's the Grasshopper Plague book.
Yeah.
It's very, I think it's definitely a book from the Depression, because it's about a farm family that loses everything and yet still holds on to optimism and hope. And that sustains them into the next book. But it was, for its period and time, giving those characters existential feelings about what was happening to them was new and novel for juvenile fiction in the 1930s. And I think young readers would have understood that.
Yeah, let's dig into the, it's a good segue to dig into that realism that she, that you make the point she's one of the first people to really do that with juvenile literature and young adult literature, is to respect their ability to take that in and to contemplate these rough times, these accidents and plagues and grasshoppers and crop failures and long winters. How would, if she had remained in the conventional writing mode, how might she have portrayed the long winter as a book? What would be different without the realism?
Well, I think if you read Hattie Woodlawn by Carol Ryrie Brink,
okay,
or if you read the Janie Grant books by Florence Crennel Means, both of them were publishing these frontier books in the 1930s. The books dealt with pioneer families, and Florence Crennel Means, Janie Grant character, her family suffered through hard winters, prairie fires, grasshopper plagues. There's also a very strong undercurrent of tension with Native American characters in those books. But in the Janie Grant series, it's all kind of an adventure. The books never really linger on what being wiped out by grasshoppers might actually mean to a family. Everything, characters just kind of swim through these adventures. And I think a real example, which is one of the examples that I used at Laurapalooza in my presentation, is the contrast between Laura Ingalls, who's a preschooler in Little House on the Prairie, and Caddy Woodlawn in the book by the same title, Caddy Woodlawn. Both of those books were published in 1935. And the contrast between the two of them, and don't get me wrong, I love Caddy Woodlawn. I devoured it when I was a kid, and I have reread it multiple times as an adult. But there's a really distinct difference between how Wilder handles existential threats to her characters and how Carol Ryrie Brink brings existential experiences into her book. So in Caddy Woodlawn, Caddy and her brothers and sisters are coming home from school one day, and they get caught in a thunderstorm, and a big bolt of lightning strikes a big tree right in front of them. And the lightning bolt devastates the tree, and the kids gasp, and they cry. And then they run home to tell their mother, guess what happened to us? And that's how the chapter ends. That's as deep as emotional realism goes there. There's really none. It's all on the surface. Mm-hmm. In the opening pages of Little House on the Prairie, the family gets swept up essentially in a flash flood. Pa has misjudged the depth and swiftness of a creek. And the wagon almost capsizes. Laura sees Pa's beard swimming in the river. You know, it's this very dark, scary scene. And of course they get out on the, they're safe. The wagon emerges safely on the other side. But Laura, as a preschooler, realizes that the river, that the creek could have rolled them over and over and over again and swept them away, and no one would ever have known what happened to them. That's really a dark existential thought. It's very realistic.
Yeah.
But it was very unusual for a juvenile character to have that kind of realization in a juvenile novel of the 1930s. And of course, that set a precedent for what we now know as middle grade fiction, because that kind of emotional depth and realism is now a convention in 21st century literature for young readers. But it was brand new when Wilder developed it. And if you read those books alongside the books that her contemporaries were writing, the difference is really striking and very dramatic.
Well, it gives something to people of all ages. I think if you, a parent reading that story to your children, and you've ever had a close call, it might inform how you're, the tone of your reading and all kinds of things. And then you might share some details about your close call in life with your kids. And so that's a founding thing, but certainly, or a relationship building opportunity for parents and young kids to take out of the books. How was the realism at the time responded to? Did audiences, what did the ALA think of Little Town on the Prairie or the later books as they're getting more and more? And by the way, that's the other thing too that I didn't realize. She's not got a contract for a multi-book series. She's doing them one at a time.
Well, let's start with going back to Little House on the Prairie and Caddy Woodlawn.
Sure.
Because Little House on the Prairie did not receive any recognition from the American Library Association. Caddy Woodlawn won the Newbery Medal that year. Those were books. They were published the same year in 1935. And I think the ALA perhaps worried that that realism was too raw, too gritty for young readers in the at that period. But the next book in the series, On the Banks of Plum Creek, was a Newbery Honor Book that year. It did not receive the medal. In fact, the remaining five books in the Little House series are all Newbery Honor Books, but Wilder never received the medal itself. Mm. And I think it probably was because she was still ahead of the curve. And I just recently read, I read the book that won the Newbery Medal in 1938, the same year that On the Banks of Plum Creek was a Newbery Honor Book. And the book is called The White Stag. I actually have it here. The artwork is just gorgeous.
Yep, striking. Yep.
It's beautiful artwork. But the book is basically a very epic retelling of the story of Attila the Hun. And there's no real emotional depth or connection to the character. The language is kind of pretentious. It's very elevated. You know, it doesn't have that gritty realism of On the Banks of Plum Creek. So I suspect that librarians at the American Library Association were just a little nervous about that kind of gritty emotional realism that Wilder was bringing to young readers. Mm-hmm. And yet they had to admit that a book like On the Banks of Plum Creek was a literary achievement. So they couldn't quite give it the medal, so they listed it as an honor book. Mm-hmm. And Ursula Nordstrom, Wilder's longtime editor at Harper & Brothers, also believed that there was a general prejudice against Wilder's books because they were series books, that they were not standalone books.
Oh, okay.
And yet, each one of those books stands on its own merit. You don't have to read the whole series to see the literary artistry in each of those books.
Yeah, it's probably the way her contracts worked out, one at a time. It's probably better for the reader that it worked out that way because she was writing that way, right? And they had to.
Well, you know, something we haven't talked about, going back to Little House in the Big Woods, the manuscript was initially accepted by Alfred Knopf.
That's right.
And they presented Wilder with a 5-book deal, or a multi-book deal, I should say.
Okay.
Multi-book deal. And before Wilder could sign the contract, her editor at Knopf wrote and said, don't sign the contract because Knopf is getting rid of its juvenile division.
Yeah.
A reflection, I think, of hard times publishers were having during the Depression. And so Wilder's editor at Knopf apparently approached Virginia Kirkus at Harper & Brothers and said, hey, this is a manuscript you need to look at. And of course, as we've already talked about, Kirkus fell in love with it. But
yeah.
I think because of the hard times publishers were facing during the Great Depression, she offered just a contract on that particular title.
Okay.
And so it was one contract at a time for the rest of the Little House series with Harper.
Right. As you get further into the book and the chapters, and I've kind of alluded to this before, a lot of the narrative, the development of the stories and so forth, Laura's back and forth with her professional writer daughter, Rose, who was born in, well, South Dakota, born in South Dakota, and then moved on and has since had a pretty respectable writing career in her own right. And she is often credited for writing the books or having more authorship and so forth. But they seem to be having arguments, if not deep discussions about philosophical things with how the narrative should play out. And Laura seems to be on the winning side and probably the side that would respect the reader more than Rose was and more intuitively than we might today or many people today might give her credit for. I wonder if you could talk through how you work through the letters and the writing back and forth, the manuscript with the notations on the sides to piece together the story of these two women, mother and daughter, passionate out, and with the sideline that I was shocked to see that Rose kind of takes the story and tries to make it adult fiction, and her novels are largely inspired by The Pioneer Girl, the annotated biography that you've worked on before. So,
right.
Walk through some of that. I think that's the fascinating theme.
That's a lot of information to unpack. So,
yeah, it is.
But let's start with the editorial letters first, because you kind of asked me about that.
Yeah.
And the first time I read the editorial letters was when I was working on my first book, Lauren Goes Wilder, A Writer's Life, which the South Dakota Press published back in 2007. And I hadn't really decided what path I was going to take for the biography. And then suddenly I was confronted with these letters, and I call them editorial letters because writers and editors often exchange letters, and now we exchange emails back and forth, arguing about characters and theme and what should be cut and what should stay and what needs to be developed and how a novel ends and how a novel begins. And writers and editors often don't see exactly eye to eye, and so we write back and forth. And so when I found those letters between Wilder and Lane, I'm like, aha, they're having routine discussions about what to do with these books. And there wasn't really anything unusual about the correspondence as a whole, except that this was a mother and daughter acting as writer and editor, and that no one at Harper & Brothers knew this exchange was going on. Right. So that really intrigued me. And that was kind of the jumping off point for my biography. It's like, ah, this illuminates a lot of the writing process. Now, the correspondence doesn't include all of the books because Wilder and Lane were both living at Rocky Ridge Farm. As Wilder wrote Pioneer Girl, Little House on the Big Woods, Farmer Boy, and Little House on the Prairie. Okay. So the correspondence begins with Plum Creek.
Okay.
And it takes us just up to the beginning of Little House on the Prairie. We have some correspondence that shows how Wilder envisioned the rest of the series, but then suddenly the correspondence stops, and we don't know if that correspondence was just lost, if they stopped writing each other. We're not sure exactly what happened. It seems unlikely that they would have stopped talking to each other at that point. My guess is that that correspondence is lost, but that's only my guess. But that was the beginning. And what I discovered is that Lane was really good on the technical stuff, like point of view. She was also good at thinking about where a novel should begin. She could give that advice to another writer, although she didn't always take it herself.
Yeah.
But that's another story altogether. And she really helped her mother figure out things relating to plot. On the other hand, she was tone deaf, I think, to character development and dialogue and overall theme. And Wilder knew from the beginning what her books were about. She also resisted Lane's attempts at more melodrama, more sentiment in her novel, because Wilder felt that that contradicted what she called the pioneer stoicism of the time. And she thought it was important to capture that pioneer stoicism.
Did she use that term, stoicism?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
She
used that term.
And then there were some major arguments that they had, particularly after On the Banks of Plum Creek. And On the Banks of Plum Creek not only was a Newbery honor book, but Wilder's editor at Harper Brothers was so enamored of the book that she used it as a model, what she called a model juvenile, and shared it to other would-be authors who wanted to write for this audience. So Rose felt that this was really successful, that her mother should stick with juvenile fiction and continue to write in that vein. The only problem was that the fictional Laura Ingalls character was getting too old to be in a juvenile novel. And so at this point in the correspondence, Lane apparently suggests to her mother that she should switch main characters. So in the next book after On the Banks of Plum Creek, the main character in the book should be Carrie and not Laura, because Laura was too old and there would be too much adult stuff in the next book. Uh-huh. So this gets back to your question of the big picture that Wilder understood that her daughter did not.
Yeah.
And Wilder wrote back and said, we can't possibly change characters midstream, main characters midstream. What are you thinking? Of course, Laura is getting older, and she knew there was more adult stuff in the world, and she was ready to confront it. And Wilder went on to say, I believe young readers will expect this in the next book, and they will want it, and they will understand it. But what's important here is not only the argument that Wilder was having, she was realizing right then that there was a category that didn't quite exist in American literature for young readers yet, and that was young adult fiction. And so Wilder was saying, hey, we need to move on here. We need to experiment. Let's take a creative leap. We're going to make Laura older, wiser, more aware of adult stuff. And I'm going to break with convention. We're not going to play it safe and do another juvenile novel. We're going to do something different. And in doing so, she was pioneering the young adult category, which didn't formally exist in 1938 when she was planning the next book in the series, which is By the Shores of Silver Lake.
So do you think that people today, when they think of this series, look at that and this particular novel, The Shores of Silver Lake, as, oh, that's America's first young adult novel?
Hey, let's clarify. It wasn't the first American young adult novel.
Okay.
More credit goes to Little Women and Louisa May Alcott.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Great. And another great young adult novel came about 12 years later, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Mm-hmm. But both of those titles remained essentially outliers in American fiction. They were young adult novels, but the young adult category didn't really exist. So when Wilder decided to pursue the adult stuff in By the Shores of Silver Lake, the category was beginning to form, but hadn't really coalesced yet. In fact,
okay.
The American Library Association didn't recognize the term young adult fiction until 1958. And that was a year after Wilder died in 1957. Okay. So there was a movement toward young adult fiction when Wilder was writing in the 1930s. So we can safely say she was a pioneer in that category.
Right.
But she didn't write the first young adult novel. But I also agree that this is a contribution that Wilder made to American fiction for young readers that has largely been forgotten.
Well, then the other path-breaking book, I wonder if we can spend some time before we wrap up with The Meaning of the Long Winter and how that is blazing a new trail, and then close out with the other books or whatever you'd like to kind of chat about with the meaning of these books. Again, kind of a standalone novels in the literary pantheon.
I think for me anyway, now as an adult, The Long Winter is Wilder's masterpiece. When I was a kid, my favorite book was These Happy Golden Years. But as an adult, what Wilder tackles in The Long Winter is creatively enormously challenging, and she struggled with it. She at one point wrote Rose Wilder Lane, what is the plot in The Long Winter? It was, you know, again, I'm paraphrasing, it was just surviving one blizzard after another. I mean, where's the story in that? Where's the plot in that? And so she really struggled with it. And she later wrote her agent, literary agent George Bai, saying, again, I'm paraphrasing, I'm really glad I'm finished with this book because writing it and living through those experiences again was really difficult. But she did find a way through. And what I think is so remarkable about the book is that it is a novel about survival. And when you read the book as a very young reader, you just kind of skim along. You sometimes don't see the depth and the darkness that's in that book. That book is very, very dark. It's about the fear of dying from cold, the fear of dying from starvation. And she doesn't pull any punches. And toward as the characters become weaker and hungrier toward the end of the book, there are more dreamlike sequences in the book that mirror the symptoms of hunger and cold. So the text itself mirrors the feelings of her characters and the struggle that they're facing. It was a very dark book. And so I think without a book like The Long Winter, a case could be made that we might not have The Hunger Games today, because The Hunger Games right. is about survival. It's about trying to live and struggling. Of course, The Hunger Games is much more violent than The Long Winter. But The Long Winter was dealing with subjects that were especially dark and especially difficult and challenging for a publisher to accept in the late 1930s and early 1940s. And in fact, Wilder originally titled The Long Winter, The Hard Winter. Mm-hmm. And her editors at Harper & Brothers thought, ooh, that's going to be too dark. So let's just call it The Long Winter, not The Hard Winter. And if you look at the original cover design for The Long Winter, it shows the Ingalls family gathered around a warm pot-bellied stove and Pa's playing his fiddle and everybody looks warm and cozy.
Yeah.
So it gives the impression that it's just a great adventure. And then when you get into the book, It's very, very dark. And that set a new precedent for existential themes in what we now consider young adult fiction.
Well, you found some amazing sources, and I just wanted to go kind of in a, because I'm a historian and this is a history podcast, how did you use those sources to piece together all these arguments? And what, or maybe you've described some of that already, maybe a better question is, what was the most revealing source about why Laura wrote the books to begin with?
I'm going to change your question a little bit.
All right.
And I'm going to jump ahead to the last chapter in the book.
Okay.
What was the most revealing source? And I'm talking now about the first 4 years, which has never felt like it belonged to the rest of the series. And I will say this, there are letters that Wilder wrote to Rose and to her agent and her editor that indicate, that hinted that she was thinking about writing an adult novel. In fact, in 1937, when I think the first letter appears where she's hinting about writing a grown-up novel, she had already written the first 4 years.
Oh.
She actually wrote the first 4 years, it appears, in late 1932 and early 1933.
Really?
And this gets at the valuable source. The valuable source is the original manuscript, which is at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in Iowa. I had, of course, seen a lot of parallels between the first 4 years and Rose Wilder Lane's Let the Hurricane Roar. And at the time I thought, well, I guess Wilder decided to write that adult novel after all, after she finished These Happy Golden Years, and she decided to use her daughter's novel as a model. When I started thinking about writing this book, I felt like something was missing in my original analysis of the first 4 years. And Wilder scholar and author Bill Anderson and I were talking, and he said, you know, I think somewhere in the original manuscript, there's a date. And I wrote the book during the pandemic. So I had to get in touch with the archivist who I'd worked with before at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. And they sent me scans of the original manuscript. And sure enough, toward the end of the novel, and Wilder does this a lot, and she did this in Pioneer Girl in all her novels, she wrote them on tablets, and she would mark things out, or she would insert a whole scene or a whole paragraph using different piece of paper and slip them in and tape them into the manuscript. And the first 4 years manuscript, she did exactly that. And toward the end of the manuscript, on the back of a letter dated January 1933, she wrote a new scene. And so all of that suddenly clicked. We don't have time to really go into the conflict that was going on between Rose and Wilder in late 1932 and 1933. But suddenly it made a great deal of sense to me, because the structural parallels, the style, the tone of the first 4 years corresponds to Let the Hurricane Roar, which Lane published in 1932. And Wilder was upset by that book for a variety of very compelling reasons.
Right.
And so I think she wrote the first 4 years as a response to Let the Hurricane Roar in 1932 and late 1932 and early 1933. So that particular original manuscript proved to be invaluable and the most enlightening of any of the source material I used for this new book.
I'm glad you came around to that, because that was the other revealing part of this book, is that while they might be Rose and Laura, mother and daughter, are arguing about plot development and how to set up a scene and so forth, Rose is somewhat mystifyingly to me stealing her mother's Pioneer Girl and trying to get her own novel published based on that. And then later in your book, as you just explained, that she's got her own novel of that same time period. And their mother and daughter are competing, and yet they seem to get past that somehow. We don't have any evidence of how they muddle through that, or do we?
I do think that Farmer Boy helped them patch things up.
Okay.
But before we go, I should let your listeners know that, as you've mentioned, Rose Wilder Lane mined her mother's unpublished autobiography, Pioneer Girl.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think Rose Wilder Lane had run out of ideas in the 1930s. She always struggled as a novelist. And so she found in Pioneer Girl material for two Pioneer novels, and she based both of those novels. And she lifted sometimes descriptions, characters, dialogue directly out of Pioneer Girl and put them into her own novels. And she also used some of that material in short stories that she published in the 1930s. So while we tend to think that Lauren Gus Wilder owed a great deal of credit to her daughter for helping editorially with the Little House books, I think an equally strong argument can be made that without Laura Ingalls Wilder's Pioneer Girl, without Laura Ingalls Wilder's work, Rose Wilder Lane would not have had a career as a novelist and fiction writer in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And I do think that they somehow patched it up over Farmer Boy. I think that trip that Lane took to Malone, New York, perhaps softened the blow and bridged the gap between them, because I think tensions were running very high in late 1932.
Yeah, it's interesting, and we'll leave readers to go into the book and read for themselves and think through that. I just wanted to finish up on how Laura gets started writing in the first place. And you have that reproduced in the book, I believe, or you showed to the Laura Palooza audience the copy of the critique that she got from her teacher in DeSmet about her writing. I wonder if you'd talk just a bit about that and what that meant to her.
What I think is really interesting, she writes about this episode in Pioneer Girl. And of course, she writes about it again in the last novel, These Happy Golden Years. What I think is particularly interesting is it's just a routine, short essay. There's nothing really remarkable about it, except that apparently then Owen, her teacher, praised her for it. And Wilder kept that assignment for the rest of her life. And what's revealing about it, too, is in These Happy Golden Years, Wilder writes the ambition essay perfectly when she gets the praise from her school teacher. But if you look at the original manuscript, she wrote a first version, didn't like it, marked it out, turned it over on the other side, and wrote and rewrote it. So in some ways, I think that's more revealing. She was already beginning to think like a writer. It's like, oh, this first draft isn't right. Let's write the second one. But I think it must have been an important turning point for her, because how many of us would keep an assignment essentially from high school for the rest of our lives? And of course, then think about it. She packed it up and brought it with her when she and Almanzo and Rose moved from South Dakota to Missouri. That was one of the things she brought with her. So I think it illustrates that he encouraged her to write, or perhaps she always had a lingering ambition to write, because by 19th century standard, the Ingalls family was a very literary family.
Yeah, I've been rereading Little Town on the Prairie, and I'm struck by how they know about New York fashion. It's a subject of their talk all the time, Ma and her daughters, and they are aspiring to do that, even though while they're making their own clothes, but they're certainly aware of it. They know what's in fashion. They know what's out of fashion. And I had forgotten about that since I read it in the fourth, fifth grade. Anyway, I've been speaking with Pamela Smith-Hill, author of the new book, Too Good to Be Altogether Lost, Rediscovering Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House Books. Pamela, thank you for joining History 605. It's been a great conversation.
This has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Ben.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.